of us in that salvation. So as we go along here, he starts with the antithesis of the obedience of faith. He goes to show us those who have rejected, okay, God's truth for a lie. They plunge into sin as deep as you can go. The truth of God was revealed through creation, but they opted to suppress that truth and turn to idolatry. This, as we've talked about, is the descent of the mind here. And when we get to verse 21, you know, in the background, there's this reality. What is ultimately man's problem? Is it the mind? Yeah, it's the will. And we're talking about different facets of the will here. And so, you know, it's the will. And we're going to see that loud and clear. Let's just look at the will thus far in our passage. Here we see that even though they knew God, what did they do with it? Okay. What was their response? They did not honor him as God or give him thanks. And so that knowledge that was there was rejected. Okay, and then we get to verse 23, they exchanged the glory. So again, they knew God, but they exchanged it. All right, and then verse 18, all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth and unrighteousness. So again, we're looking that the will, okay, is ultimately rejecting what is being conveyed through creation. And we have chronicled this descent right here. They move from indifference to speculation to ignorance to idolatry. And now we're going to enter into this section where he's given us, remember verse 19 begins with because, okay? He gives us the positive cause for the wrath of God. God has clearly revealed himself through creation, okay? Then he gives the negative that's been rejected. It's been met with this suppression of the truth revealed in creation. And now God responds with that wrath. There's this divine abandonment that takes place. And so as we think about this and we think about Jesus on this very matter, this is what I see Paul saying. This is what I see unfolding in our passage here, John chapter 7, what do we see here? So Jesus answered them and said, my teaching is not mine, but him who sent me. If anyone is willing to do his will, he will know of the teaching, whether it is of God or whether I speak from myself. See, man's ultimate problem is his will. The reason he's darkened in his understanding is because there's a problem with the will. That's why it wasn't getting through. Okay, you look at John chapter 8, we see basically the same reality. He's speaking to some Jews there who had just believed, it says. And it says, why do you not understand what I am saying? It is because you cannot hear my word. You are of your father, the devil, and you want to do the desires of your father. Okay, so man's ultimate problem is his will. It's this rejection of the truth. And as long as your will is in rebellion to the truth, well, the truth is going to be an enigma to you. Now, interestingly enough, we're talking about people who've made that journey, okay? They've made that journey from even though they knew God, okay, they rejected that reality and then were plunged into ignorance. By the time we get to the end of this passage, we see that this leads to a hardness, okay? They're steeped in this. Eventually, that's the end of that road. And we talked last week about apostates and how apostates function on this level. They function on the level of the intellect. They intellectually grasp these things, but eventually it's shown that their will is not truly committed to that truth. It's like James says, even the demons believe and tremble. Well, today we get to man's real problem, his will. His will takes center stage. And there's a specific facet of his heart that is explained in our passage today. Why are we there? We should be back on... I'm sorry. Go ahead. I didn't put this on there. Sorry. If you just look at verse 24, this is where we're starting out here today. It says, therefore God gave them over in the lusts of their heart. Okay. So now he brings out this specific facet of their lusts, their desires that dwell inside. Lust is equal to, you know, desire. It's the idea of the will. These desires of the will are what lead people to turn from what they know to be true. Okay, that's what we're seeing unfold here. And these desires are already there. They're already at work. This isn't talking about the fall. These are already fallen individuals, okay? It's not talking about the fall. Their wills are already against God. Lust is already dwelling there. What he's doing is letting that lust have complete control over them, okay? He's letting that lust have complete control over them. He's restraining it up until this point, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But that's what we're going to talk about here today, is this reality of the destructiveness of the lusts of the heart and what they do to people when God gives them over to them. Any questions or thoughts before we start here tonight? Okay. Who would like to read verses 24 and 25 for us? Andrew. Okay, thank you. I would view these two verses as transitional, okay? He is moving from man's response to God to God's response to man. And this kind of makes that transition. In this, he first mentions in verse 24 God's response to man, and then he again sums up what he's just said about man's response to God. You know, again, verse 24 looks ahead to where he's going to go, and verse 25 looks back to where he's been, all right? There's a bit of a transition taking place here. Now, where has he been? Verse 25 summarizes the cause. It says, "For they exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the creator." So this goes back to that verse 19, because... Okay, he's given this cause for us, and he sums it up in just one succinct statement in verse 25. They exchanged the truth of God for a lie. Why does Paul use the singular, the truth of God for a lie, singular, in this passage? Do we only see one idol in the world today? Okay, we see lots of idols. Okay, Paul talked about Athens being the city full of idols, and no two are alike. Okay, they're pretty personalized. Why does Paul use the singular rather than the plural? What is he indicating about this idolatry?
He's still talking about the sin in the heart.
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah, that's all kind of part of the discussion here. But what is? Why would he say a lie?
Total rejection.
Okay. Okay.
Later on, we learn that there is no such a thing as an idol.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the big lie here. It's in opposition to truth.
Okay. Yeah, fundamentally, there's only one lie that is taking place here, no matter how many ways it manifests itself. The fundamental lie that he's referring to here is the idea that they worship and serve the creature rather than the creator. So, you know, what... Whatever that idol is, fundamentally the error or the lie they're embracing is that they're serving the creature rather than the creator. So he's emphasizing the essence of the sin involved. Okay, he's emphasizing the essence of the sin involved rather than the each individual particular manifestation of that. Okay, so, all right. Well, why does Paul interject at the end, "Who is blessed forever, amen"? Why does he say that at the end of his summary in verse 25? He talks about what they're doing, and then he interjects this, who is blessed forever. Amen. Why would he do that?
Perhaps to indicate that God is justifying these decrees toward his people.
Okay. Yeah, I could definitely see that. I guess I was thinking in more in the lines of he's making sure that he's not with them. It's like, again, this is the antithesis of what it is to be a Christian, okay? This is the antithesis, and he gets done saying it, and it's almost like he feels dirty. He's like, who is blessed forever. I mean, I don't engage in this on any way, shape, or form. He's distancing himself from this reality. We talked about that last time about how, they did not honor him as God or give thanks. Well, Paul is doing that. When confronted with the reality of God as the creator, our response should be, who is blessed forever. Amen. We want to bless God as our creator. That's the camp he wants to be identified with. Now, where is Paul going? That's what we see in verse 24. He says, therefore, God gave them over in the lusts of their hearts to impurity so that their bodies would be dishonored among them. Let me paraphrase this for you. This is the way I would paraphrase it, is God gave them over through the lusts of their hearts to impurity. That's the idea here, is that really the means of this, what brings about this impurity is found within them. Okay, it's not that God is somehow defiling them. He let them defile themselves. He did it. I mean, he is sovereign over this reality, but he did so through the lusts of their hearts. Okay? He's not the one defiling them. He's letting them defile themselves. The word lust here is epithumia. It literally means strong desire, and we see it used positively in the scriptures, positively in the New Testament. The word is not inherently negative. It depends on the context, whether it's negative. Clearly, this is negative here, so hence lust is how it's translated here. In other places, very clearly, it's used in a positive sense, though. Now, again, the desires were already there, but they were being held in check. Okay, they were being held in check. Now that restraint is removed and these desires are allowed to dominate them. When we think about what restrains man's lusts, the lusts of his heart, the desires, the evil desires in context very clearly here, what restrains evil desires? What reality restrains evil desires? Okay. And that's the one I'm thinking of. Certainly, we could talk about government. Government restrains evil too. In this context, where he ends up going with this, very clearly, I think the conscience is implied here. It would seem that what God is removing, what we get into that conversation, what is the conscience? We're only told so much. It's something within the man that, according to Romans chapter 2, we'll just look at this here. Why am I having such a hard time with this? Am I missing a slide somewhere? I'm looking for Romans 2, 14 through 16. That's fine, if you could just find it. Okay, thank you. Romans chapter 2, verse 14 through 16. When Gentiles who do not have the law do instinctively the things of the law, these, not having the law, are a law to themselves, in that they show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience bearing witness, and their thoughts alternately accusing or else defending them. On the day when, according to my gospel, God will judge the secrets of men through Christ Jesus. Now, it's interesting. Here we have a description of how the conscience functions. It either convicts, it condemns, or it affirms. It says, yeah, this feels good, I should do that. No, this feels wrong, I shouldn't do that. Okay, so that's what the conscience is, and this, as he points out here, creates this inhibit, it inhibits what the desires that well up inside the heart, okay? It curbs them, that conviction and so forth. What must be taking place here, and again, this is just a bit of a deduction here, is that this process is taken away. It's kind of interesting that when he talks about the conscience, he addresses it to the moralist pagan, okay? And the moralist pagan, his conscience is working. And what he seems to be saying here in this passage is that's going to be a problem for you on Judgment Day, okay? Because you're going to be judged by that conscience. Now, the abject pagan's going to be judged, and everybody knows they're going to be judged. Why? Because we see them eating their just desserts now. I mean, we see that they are getting it now. And the moralist seems to have escaped. But one day, even that conscience that he thinks is a benefit to him will be an instrument of judgment upon him. And so, again, I think the conscience is what separates the abject pagan from the moralist pagan. Well, this giving them over, okay, this giving them over to the results are, it says impurity. This is the idea of uncleanness. It indicates defilement in this context due to unbiblical sex. And it's kind of interesting, this idea of defilement or uncleanness, very common in the Old Testament. And you could talk about objects being defiled. Really, in the New Testament, when we talk about things being unclean in the New Testament or defiled in some sense, impurity, as this word implies, it usually relates to the body. That seems to be the only thing that concept is applied to. You know, we don't sit there and say, my pen is defiled. You know, we got to burn that or whatever, wash it with water and so forth. But, yes.
And it's common to see that idolatry, sexual immorality, they go together.
Yes. And what I would see here, let's see, where are we at? We're in verse 24 still? Yes. Yeah, we haven't gotten to the next section yet. And you bring up a valid point, and I might as well say this now, is some see a progression here. Some see that in verse 24, he's just saying that they're engaged in sexual immorality. And then a progression in that comes in verse 26. He says, now we're into homosexuality. Okay, so there's kind of this extra stair step down. I would see it more as he's transitioning. And what he's speaking of at this point is, a general description, and then he's going to get more specific what he means by impurity in a moment. But yeah, you're right. I mean, idolatry is very debasing. I mean, it always historically has been. I mean, there's nothing, that is absolutely right. I guess I just wanted to interject there as far as I would see this as a general description followed by a more specific description in verses 26 to 27. Again, I think he's transitioning here to his next thought. Okay. Oh, dishonored. I wanted to talk about the word dishonored. Dishonored is the idea of being treated shamefully, to disgrace. Okay. That's another way that you can describe the treatment of the body with reference to sexual immorality. Okay. Any questions or thoughts? Let's go ahead and look at verse 26, 27. Anyone? Yes. Yes. Under the Old Testament, I mean, objects could be defiled, though. I guess what he's laying emphasis to is that the greater defilement, the real issue before God is what's coming out, is not what's affecting the outside, but what's going on the inside. So they were kind of caught up on the outside. They're all focused on, I don't want to touch a dead fly, I'll be defiled then. No, he's saying, no, you're worried about the wrong things. What's defiling you is what's in here. Okay, the desires are what's defiling you. So it's just a priority. It's not either or, but which one's more significant to God? Yes?
Jason, I think it's curious, how the Lord put things together, right? In verse 21, it said they did not glorify God. They did not honor God.
Mm-hmm.
So God gives them over
to disgrace. Yeah. That's right. Go ahead and be dishonored. That's right. Exactly. Yeah, he returns the favor. Yeah, this is total just desserts. Everything they did to God, he's now doing to them. Absolutely. Yep. Excellent point. Yes, Marianne.
Okay, I just want to clarify. So the conscience separates the abject pagan from the moralist.
Correct.
In that the abject pagan's conscience is already defiled,
I would say that what's being restrained here is the conscience is no longer saying don't do that. It's a seared conscience. It's what Paul calls a seared conscience, where it's just not working. And what we're seeing here is these people, their conscience doesn't work, and they just plunge into the filth of it all. Yeah, there's nothing restraining them at this point, and they're just at the mercy of their lusts. Okay, well, let's go ahead and read here. Who would like to read verses 26 and 27? Vince.
26, 27. For this reason, God gave them up to wild passions, or even their women exchanged the natural use of what is against nature. Likewise, also the men, even the natural use of the woman, burning their lust for one another, men with men, omitting what is shameful, and receiving in themselves the penalty of their error, which was due.
Okay, thank you. Verse 26 begins, for this reason. This would seem to indicate that he's returning to what he started in verse 24. He's weaving back and forth. He's bouncing back and forth between these realities. And he just named in verse 25 the cause, which he had developed previously up into verse 23. And now he's just reiterating, for this reason. He talks about degrading passions. This is the noun form of the verb translated dishonored in verse 24. So there's another connection, you know, between these verses as far as what he's saying here, parallel thoughts. And passions. Passions is interesting. We get our word pathos from this. And, of course, pathos is the idea of the quality, having the quality of arousing pity or sorrow. And in the Greek language, it just meant a suffering. Okay, it meant a suffering. This is an intense desire similar to lust. This is always used negatively in the scripture. It's never used positively as epithumia is. But, it's always used with reference to a strong sexual longing, okay, that a person suffers under. You know, it is gnawing away at them. It wearies them and so forth. Again, God is merely letting what dwells within in them to destroy them. It says, for their women exchange the natural function for that which is unnatural. Now I think he's getting specific. What are we talking about? He's talked in generalities. Now he's getting specific down to the nitty-gritty here. And again, this exchange is taking place. This is the same word in verse 25. They exchanged the truth of God for a lie. This is now an exchange that they perhaps never saw coming. This is now, well, as he'll say, it's getting bizarre. Again, the root word occurs in verse 23, exchange the glory. So several exchanges taking place here. And this exchange now is the final one. Okay, this is the final exchange. Since these people like to exchange things, God lets them go all the way. And now, as he says here, they are now exchanging the natural function for that which is unnatural. Natural, unnatural. This is from a family of words indicating that which is according to nature, the nature of a thing. We've been talking about the creation. So, according to the nature of the creation that man has been presented with, he's been rejecting. Well, now it seems to be getting back to just basic things now. Okay? Very basic things here. Things that are inherent in nature. Things that, shall we say, are instinctive to man. It is an instinctive thing for a man to be attracted to a woman. Okay? Now we have just stepped into a realm where we're not in that instinct anymore. We are now in the realm of unnatural instinct, unnatural desires. Okay? These people are now totally rejecting the most basic truths revealed in God's creation. To put it perhaps humorously and hopefully not crassly, God made Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve. Right? I mean, we say that, and it's kind of humorous, but it's humorous because of just how obvious it is. This is just so basic. This is so rudimentary. God made Adam and Eve. He didn't make Adam and Steve. Well, where do we find ourselves today? Now you can throw up the cartoon. This is the Boy Scout Association handbook updates. We now have a Boy Scout, clearly a girl. We also have a palm tree, a turtle, due south, it's pointing north, canteen, and a square knot. And it's highlighting what? The ridiculousness of this notion. I mean, this is so unnatural. It's called the Boy Scouts, right? Why are we having girls in the Boy Scouts? We are getting so confused on the very basic things of creation, and you could see this suppression just going to the absolute, you know, limits of rejecting God. As far as we can possibly go, it's just insanity. It's ridiculous at this point. He continues on, he says, and in the same way, also, the men abandoned the natural function of the woman and burned in their desire toward one another, men with men committing indecent acts. Here we see what Paul intends by natural function. He references the woman, okay? The natural function that he has in view here, what comes naturally and is obvious in creation is that, intercourse is to happen between a male and a female, not a male and a male. Indecent acts, this means unseemliness. It's kind of an interesting word. It comes from a word that means shapeless, okay? Shapeless. Homosexuality is so bizarre and so contrary to what comes naturally, there's really no word to describe it. It's just blah. You know, what is that? Okay, how does that fit into this universe? It doesn't. It's so contrary that Paul just says it's an unseemly act. There's nothing sane about it here. It says, and receiving in their own person the due penalty of their error. Again, this word error, this error here, is literally a wandering, a straying from a path. The picture is, the word picture is one of creation lays out a very specific path. And you have to here they've stepped off of it. Very clear path in creation that says, a man and a woman. A woman and a man. Not a man and a man. And so they've stepped off. They've veered off. It's really more of the idea of a deception. It says, receiving their own persons the due penalty of their deception. But as we see, the word there is very significant because it indicates a self-deception. Remember, this is their own lust that has done this. This is their own lust that have driven them to this insanity where they're not even functioning according to the basic basic reality of creation. Yes.
I see almost like a snowball here. You know, they get in motion. It's not in their own will, they get this snowball in motion.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then the snowball carries them.
Yeah.
So they start the movement, and then they can't control it anymore.
That's right. It's like a Warner Brothers cartoon, you know, that they're sitting, Looney Tunes or whatever. And yeah, he's rolling up the ball and pretty soon he's in the ball and he's rolling down the hill. Yeah, that's exactly right. It's kind of, they started this, okay, and they didn't want God and they chose to go another path. And now he's like, okay, well, let's see where that takes you. And this is where it takes them. This is reaching the bottom here. Okay, let's talk a little bit about the due penalty that he references here. It's kind of interesting. He speaks of the due penalty of their self-deception. This is fundamentally the idea of you reap what you sow. Okay, this is the underlying premise of the book of Proverbs. There's nothing new here. This is eating your just desserts. Proverbs very much function, the underlying premise of the Proverbs is you do this, guess what? This is going to happen. You do something bad, you're going to suffer for it. You do something morally right, then you're going to be rewarded for that. okay? And not just in the next life, but even in this life. I mean, wisdom has its benefits, and wisdom is kind of like realizing the moral fabric of the creation and responding accordingly. If you're lazy, you won't be able to eat. If you work hard, well, you know, you'll stand before kings. And so you have all these realities, these cause-effect realities, and this is just in line with those. When you reach this level, when God lets you go and you're delving into this sin, guess what? There's a cause-effect reality, and you're going to reap what you sow. Now, what do we hear from homosexuals today? What is the cause of all their woes? Okay, yeah, lack of tolerance, right? And society isn't accepting me. So therefore, you are the root of all my problems. You know, Southview Bible Church, you people, I can't believe what you're talking about tonight. You know, you're hurting my self-esteem. This is the root of their problems in their mind. And yet, Scripture makes it very clear that the root is what? Yeah, there's lust. There's sin that their lusts have plunged them into. So there's some things inherent to homosexuality, and it carries with it its own consequences, okay? I thought this was interesting. You know, why listen to, the party crowd, or, you know, I should say, you know, the party line or whatever. It's interesting when you look at the world, even what the world says about homosexuality, there's problems there. Okay, this is the American Psychiatric Association. You could go to their website, APA.org, and this is what they say. Higher rates of major depression, generalized anxiety disorder, and substance use or dependence in lesbian and gay youth. Higher rates of recurring major depression among gay men. Higher rates of anxiety, mood, and substance use disorders. And suicidal thoughts among people ages 15 to 54. Now remember, these are people who are pro-homosexual. I mean, they're not condemning them in any way, shape, or form. They're just looking at this and saying, hey, this is why we need to help them. Okay, this is why the APA exists. Anyway, it says 15 to 54 with same-sex partners. Higher use of mental health services in men and women reporting same-sex partners. We explored whether ongoing discrimination fuels anxiety, depression, and other stress-related mental health problems among LGB people. The authors found strong evidence of a relationship between the two. And so here we are again. This is what we said. Society is the root of all the problems here. We're just not being tolerant enough. It's kind of interesting to me. Our society is wildly tolerant of homosexuality. It's lauded today. And yet these problems aren't going away. They're not going away in the slightest. What is the deal here? The National Alliance on Mental Health says essentially the same thing. For LGBTQ people ages 10 to 24, suicide is one of the leading causes of death. LGBTQ youth are 4 times more likely, and questioning youth are 3 times more likely to attempt suicide, experience suicidal thoughts, or engage in self-harm than straight people. An estimated 20 to 30% of LGBTQ people abuse substances compared to about 9% of the general population. 25% of LGBT, there's no Q on that one. It wasn't a typo by me, I just cut and pasted it. People abuse alcohol compared to 5 to 10% of the general population. So again, they're observing there's a major difference here. There's a major problem with this lifestyle that brings on all these personal and social problems. If you look at HIV.gov, a government website who gives statistics concerning these things, it's kind of interesting to me. When you look at estimated annual HIV infections, of course, they're, you know, it's declined 18%. All right. But when you look at this, homosexuals account for 70% of new infections. That's kind of an interesting thought. Here we see this disease. It is fundamentally a homosexual problem, okay? And this ultimately is part of the fruit, and of course I won't even get into why they think that is, but there is a higher rate of infection with homosexual males than there is with any other category of person who has received the disease. And of course, you can see this. These are females and these are males. Of course, they're looking at different categories of males in that. But the predominant is a male problem, and it is a homosexual male problem. This was put out in 1994, and this is interesting because this was the Family Research Institute, which would basically uphold, you know, they would claim to be Christian. They would uphold Christian values, moral values. And they did a little research back in 94 and entitled it The Longevity of Homosexuals Before and After the AIDS Epidemic. Now, what's interesting about this is that it was immediately criticized. This is erroneous. There's nothing factual about it. Okay. These people obviously had an agenda and they cooked the books and this is how they got their numbers. What's interesting here is this study was actually redone in 1997 and they found basically the same results. And this was done in Canada. This was in the Internal Journal of Epidemics, I guess, the study of epidemics. But this was in a Canadian journal. This was a Canadian group. They did a study in Canada. And it says, in a major Canadian center, life expectancy at age 20 years for gay and bisexual men is 8 to 20 years less than for all men. If the same pattern of mortality were to continue, we estimate that nearly half of gay and bisexual men currently aged 20 years will not reach their 65th birthday. Under even the most liberal assumptions, gay and bisexual men in this urban center are now experiencing a life expectancy similar to that of that experienced by all men in Canada in the year 1871. So they have taken a quantum leap back as far as their life expectancy. And again, these are individuals who are not anti-gay. Okay, they were actually trying to disprove the research institute, but they found basically the same findings. It shortens their life by about 20 years. This is a statement out of MacArthur, and we've talked about, you know, the problems, you know, the various problems that they encounter, both physical and spiritual, okay, as far as their anxiety and so forth. This was interesting. This was out of MacArthur's commentary. And it says, in his biography, Where Death Delights, by Marshall Hootz, 1967, the New York City forensic expert Dr. Milton Helpern, who makes no claim of being a Christian and avoids making moral judgments about homosexuality, nevertheless comments that after having performed thousands of autopsies, he would warn anyone who chooses a homosexual lifestyle to be prepared for the consequences. When we see brutal multiple wound cases in a single victim, we just automatically assume that we're dealing with a homosexual victim and a homosexual attacker. I don't know why it is so, but it seems that the violent explosions of jealousy among homosexuals far exceed the jealousy of a man for a woman or a woman for a man. The pent-up charges and energy of the homosexual relationship simply cannot be contained. When the explosive point is reached, the results are brutally violent. But this is the normal pattern of these homosexual attacks. Multiple stabbings, the multiple senseless beatings that obviously must continue long after the victim dies. When we think about what he's describing here, of course, this is just one man's experience in New York City as far as his experience as a forensic expert and, you know, seeing autopsies and so forth. When we look at this and he makes that statement, simply cannot be contained. Pent-up charges and energy of the homosexual relationship simply cannot be contained. Where do we see that in our passage today? Why can they not simply be contained? Yeah, he gave them over. I think what we're seeing is what any unbeliever could become if God gives you over. I mean, this isn't, you know, this is ultimately just God letting your lusts have your way in your life, okay? And when he gives you over, he's looking at this and it's just like, there is no restraint. There is no conscience. I mean, this person, you know, has some major, major rage going on inside of them. And where is that rage coming from? What are they really mad about?
They're mad about God.
Yeah. Yeah. Remember, this is rebellion against God ultimately. And this is that rebellion. And you see in statements like this, it's like, okay, when God lets you go, Where does that leave you? Okay. It leaves you a monster. Okay. It leaves you a monster. And so this is the progress of the abject pagan when God gives them over to the lusts of their hearts. Again, this doesn't describe all of humanity. It's just, you know, that progression that takes place. We still haven't talked about the moralist, and we haven't talked about the Jew, where God is still restraining them through the conscience and through his revelation. Any questions or thoughts here tonight before we close? Yes, Andrew. Yeah. Yeah. And just even unchecked, you know, that idea of it being unchecked, it's not a good thing when, you know, penalties are relaxed, you know, by the government and so forth for crimes. It just leads to proliferation, you know, it's epidemic. So, all right, well, let's go ahead and take some prayer requests here.